But there is, well, there was a point here, and it just went poof out of my head. So
I'm just
going to have to throw it back to you guys.
Do you guys have any advice for students or other people who are interested in development and interested in third world countries in general, but don't have, or even in their own communities, like here in the United States? And do you have advice on what the best way to do that is? To both of you, Kayla and Steve.
I guess you should really look into what your university or maybe even your high school might have some sort of program. Like there's things like, Engineers Without Borders.
Mm-hmm,
they have programs
right.
like that. They have, like, just look around your university or high school, and they should have some sort of program. But if not, like, there's also just starting locally
mm-hmm.
with what you have here, because that would be more feasible and, like, cost efficient, I would say.
Right. And certainly when you're talking about
yeah.
sustainability,
yeah.
you've got more of a chance of making it sustainable if you're working right in your own hometown,
yeah.
basically. So that's definitely true. Any thoughts, Steve?
Yeah, I would definitely second that. I mean, if you want to do something, it's always great to just, you know, sort of think, read, find as much information as you can, and then decide for yourself what the best thing to do is. But if you really just want to start tomorrow, I think starting locally and just find a tutoring program, tutor a student mm-hmm. as remediation, that always helps. It's proven with RCTs, randomized controlled trials.
Excellent. Excellent.
Thank you guys for coming in and talking with us today. It was really awesome hearing from both of you about all your experiences.
So we were talking with Steve
White and Kayla Biko.
And you guys, the two of you will both be continuing on at MIT for the next year, in some cases 2, maybe 3 years. Do you have plans for the next break to go? Kayla had said she was going to go to the Philippines. And Steve, do you have plans to step beyond the Poverty Action Lab walls?
Yeah, well, this IAP, I'm working with Teach for America in Jacksonville, Florida. So I did the international thing last year. Now I'm doing the domestic.
Cool. Taking it back home. Excellent.
Nice.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. And it is almost, this is like amazing that we're finishing on time here, my friends. It is 7 o'clock and you're listening to WMBR Cambridge 88.1 FM. And Music for Humans is up next. Gracias y hasta la próxima.
for human. I am a Dr. Janis Sakran, and I welcome you. Told you who I am. I'm a Dr. Janis Sakran here on Music for Human. And I have with me today first, well, a great many very important people. But first we have Professor Levine. Professor, are you there?
I am here, and I must say that today it's an especially broad and deep pleasure to be with you and with all our listeners.
Well, indeed, our pleasure is also great. We also have with us Aurora, speech specialist.
Vocal therapist. Thank you for allowing me to be back.
Well, I think that the other incidents have been forgotten. So it's wonderful to have you back with us now.
Yes, we've all forgiven you, I think, at this point.
And all experiences are mutually enlightening in the end.
It can be so. I think that some experiences that I have had, I would rather not have had them. But just the same, it is good that you are once again with us. We also have live in the studio Dr. Zina Pfannkuchen, who is a Marxian neologistical person.
Thank you for having me. I must say that I have just such a heart full of warmth and heartfelt greetings for all of you here. And the last couple of times that I've appeared, it has been remotely, unfortunately. And I've noticed your beard has grown, Doctor, and I see that Aurora is looking lovely. So I am glad that we're all doing well in the same co-presence.
It's interesting you mentioned the beard, because obviously our listeners can't see the beard,
but they can perhaps feel its presence.
Perhaps. And I would like everyone to know that I have chosen to grow the beard, and it is currently growing, even now as we speak. So our engineer has told us that we have begun to attempt something that has never been done, as far as we know, which is to bring in two more voices, but digitally. So let us see if that has occurred. Arthur, are you there?
Yeah, am I coming through those lines?
Yes, we can hear you there, Arthur.
Oh, okay, good. Now, you're coming through just a little bit faint, so if there's a way to...
There is a way to raise the...
You take the physical phone lines and go digital, it breaks up a little bit.
Well, let's see if the engineer can do something about that. So let me take you off and have that dealt with.
Sure.
And difficulties like this occur all the time.
Yes, they do. In fact, I was trying to tie my shoes the other day with a new kind of knot, and I had a great deal of difficulty. It took me about 45 minutes to conduct this knot. It was referred to as a 888-64 butterfly squirrel knot, and it involves about 5 yards of shoelace. But the nice thing is that my shoes were very secure that day.
I've often found that taking the time to perfect such trivialities that we take for granted throughout the day, it can be a very enlightening and peaceful experience.
It's always important to try to, I think, achieve excellence in all things, or in certainly a great many things.
Yes, and I've heard that a great Jewish sage of the 18th century in Europe refused to wear shoelaces at all. He only wore slip-on shoes, and he actually calculated the amount of time in his life that he saved by refusing to tie his shoes. I think he calculated at about a week or two of total life existence, which he felt could be better served through meditation and prayer and ritual murder.
Was that the Gaon of Vilna?
No, that was no. That's the Chafetz Chaim.
Oh.
So the engineer indicates we should try again. Arthur, are you back?
Yeah, I'm here.
Marhaban, Arthur.
That's much better. Thank the engineer for us.
Well, we thank the engineer constantly. He's an incredibly patient individual.
And he also receives free samples of tea from Peace Child Peter and camel dung from Dr. Jollis, along with any voice therapy that he asks for.
And asks for it, he does.
Indeed. And Arthur, I understand that you have brought a Bria with you.
Yeah, do we have Bria also connected up?
Yeah, I'm here.
Wow, that's great.
Marhaban, Bria.
So, welcome to the program. I think we have, what, seven or eight nodal points approximating the circle here tonight?
Well, we already have six, and I understand that that a caller tried to call in moments ago, even before the number was announced. So hopefully we will have more, an even more true approximation later.
And the great thing is that in ancient mathematics, eight was known as the perfect number among all several thousand or so numbers in existence.
Yeah, it was an eight in particular is, a product of two, three times, and three represents the sacred, and two, of course, the first pairing in many ancient numerological systems. So there's this idea that life began with two things. When two first existed, this brought life into existence. And so three generations later, we have the sacred being born.
That's right, because with one, there's really nothing because there's no differentiation. So in a certain sense, I've always thought that atheists and monotheists really are one and the same. I mean, if there's no differentiation in the Godhead and the divine, then there really is nothing.
I would have to agree with you, Dr. Levine. I think that actually that there are many atheists who may consider themselves militantly atheists who, when you get them speaking about their values, you find that they're actually completely monotheistic, and that what they imagine monotheism to be is just some kind of fantasy.
Is Bria indeed with us?
Yes, I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're so happy to have you with us.
Thank you. There's a joyfulness about your voice. I'm anxious to hear what we're going to talk about tonight.
Well, Bria, we're very curious about you. Arthur has only introduced you in vague terms. Perhaps you could introduce yourself.
Well, my work is really to draw out or turn people on to their unique creative possibility, their unique creative potentials. And I do that by my daily life and by my particular academic studies, which involve anthropology and especially the field of ritual, looking at ritual conceptually all over the world, how it's practiced, what its histories are, how we find it today, and then kinship, which is a very personal note for me, having a family of my own and coming from a family, thinking about positions in family and tying that to ritual.
I see. I mean, and kinship, I mean, really restricted to family or kinship. I mean, I found that many of the bonds that I have felt most keenly were with those who I had very little common experience with. And I think that that is part of why that happened, that we found that, you know, with your brother, you may expect to have some commonality. But with someone that you met later, particularly very late in life, that any bond is surprising, and hence there is a great bond.
There's a term in anthropology called fictive kinship. I've always loved that phrase because it reminds you of our life as a narrative, as a fiction that we are writing our own stories. I love that, and I love that we're able to write in our own imaginary slots the kind of family and relationships and positions we want to have with those we meet, and even those that are distant in some way, or even perhaps past life in some way. That I feel a strong fictive kinship with many writers and authors who've had a tremendous power in my life.
That's interesting. I mentioned earlier that forgoing the tying of one's shoe can allow more time for some rituals, such as ritual murders. And I wonder if you've studied ritual murder in particular in your anthropological studies.
Only cannibalism. Sorry.
Oh, okay. So the cannibalism would usually be the result of a non-ritualistic murder, and it's just the consuming of the flesh, which is ritualistic.
Yeah, I can't say too much about ritual murder. Maybe someone else could speak to that.
I'd like to go back to this concept of fictive kinship, because I find in this term that there's an implicit evaluation and or devaluation of these ties that are not based on blood. Something like marriage, perhaps, is a very old institution. Also, a fairly standard understanding of fictive kinship would be marriage. And yet, fictive implies perhaps fictional, not quite as real, not quite as solid as a blood tie.
Well, I like to think about fiction as even more powerful than the sort of biology that we're handed. And in fact, most people can very readily feel strongly about shaking off the biology family that they have and seeking other kinds of relationships. You can either enhance that or it's, you know, the biology is the lowest common denominator. But to me, the imaginative stories we write have, you know, tremendous power. I don't know if you know this movie Bright Star. Has anyone seen that? I think it's about the poet Keats.
Yeah, and I don't think it's been released in the Cambridge area yet.
Well, it's again, I think there's that we make our own lives. We make the potential of our own lives and shape our own emotions and make these choices. And I love the possibility of thinking about kinship and the beautiful word kinship, and even taking it apart, looking at the kin and the ship and the two together. And there's another phrase in anthropology I love called kin keepers, and that refers to people who are making that extra special effort to do the work around keeping patterns of relationships alive. And
wow.
To me, these are really fun. They're fun possibilities, and you know, they get waylaid by maybe some things that get carried on them that are that they don't need. We can disperse with or walk lightly around in some way.
But do say that the pen is mightier than the sword, but not quite as strong as the bow and arrow. Do you find this to be true?
Well, I'm not sure where this comes in, but this idea of kin keeping, I mean, to me, well, I've met a number of people who are very, very careful about maintaining family ties, which I certainly see the place for, But I sometimes feel like it's a poor reason to maintain a tie with someone.
Well, I'd like to interject here. Speaking as someone who's been separated from her family for several years and who only rejoined with them in her 30s, I feel the different ties between blood relatives and between those who I choose to take into my sort of faux family. When I did meet up with my family, I felt as if I belonged to these people, as if there was something inherent within perhaps their biology or their spirituality that I felt a resonance within me, even though I had never seen them before. And yet, at the same time, I also have more common experiences among those that I take into my own family that I've built around myself. So both of those connections can be so real and so profound.
I think one fabulous example of how people have been taking up these concepts of families and kinships and doing new things with them and forging new forms of relationality is in the gay and lesbian community. That is to say, I'm sure our anthropologist on the line is familiar with Dr. Kath Weston and her work on Families We Choose and this concept of choosing a family. She writes about a bunch of lesbians having a Thanksgiving dinner or something of this sort, and their family. But I still think that we should work to get beyond this concept of family as central, and in fact try to say, for example, if somebody is has to leave their job, their role as a normative member of the capitalist society, then an excuse would be, well, someone in my family is ill. I must go. This is a legitimate excuse. If you say, someone, and this could be, you know, your lesbian partner, but it's still a member of this code word, the family. Whereas if I say, oh, someone in my anarchist collective is ill, this does not resonate in the same way. This is not an excuse to avoid this job in capitalist society.
My understanding was that Marx himself had advocated the slow but eventual replacement of children by pets. And I wonder, actually, if can pets be a true replacement for children and possibly even better than having children?
Do you mean treating humans as pets, or do you mean incorporating non-human animals into a social or communal structure in a more integrated way?
Right, exactly.
You know, to understand that, I feel like we need to get more into what kinkeeping is exactly, because I think anybody's extended family, you always have at least a couple people who are really into family genealogies and tracing all of that back at least, you know, four or five generations or more if possible. But what other forms of kinkeeping are there? What else can you do to hold it together? I think that's central.
I think having an actual list and a history is not so important as the general feeling of those who you are akin to. And a lot of the spirituality of the New Age movement comes into my ideology with this, that you can actually meditate within yourself and feel the structures that are behind your family, and behind those you love.
I think that genealogies really become important because some people really feel that, and in a very real way this is true, that your biology tells it is who you are or who you were born as, and all that history can tell you a lot about where you were and who you know, parts of which people you are now. So it gives you a grounding, a place within the world that you may not otherwise have felt. You know, is that clear? It's like you are part of a very, very old tradition.
Well, to a certain extent, if you look at cellular reproduction, asexual reproduction, you have one cell that splits into two, but those two cells are exactly the same as that original. And we do the same as humans, that part of us are our parents, and part of our parents are our grandparents, and so forth. Mm. And that we have been encoded for such a long time, what makes us our biological selves, but spiritually we can, and mentally we can choose our own paths. I mean, it's not all, hopefully, I don't think that all of what we are can be explained in those bread and butter sort of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen terms.
Hmm. So what's the special ingredient?
To start, I don't think that everything is on a physical plane, that our spirituality are the thing that makes us wonder about these sort of topics.
Well, just as a practical matter for myself and picking up on what Dr. Jala said, I come from a very large Orthodox Jewish family, and I have many, many siblings and many cousins and many nieces and many nephews. So I find it important to keep a family genealogy so I can just sort of remember all my living relatives, let alone the dead ones.
So you actually use it as a cheat sheet
as
for
who
is alive now.
Exactly, and when I visit my family on, you know, family holidays, I actually will write it on my palm, the palm of my hand. And so if I'm, you know, if I see someone, I can just quickly look at my hand and say, oh, hello, Shlomo. Nice to meet you. Nice to see you again.
I just love this. This is so fabulous that you would write it on your hand and look at that, you know, during a family dinner or family time. And maybe perhaps even shake someone with that same hand, you know, shake another hand. I just think that's a wonderful imagery of kinkeeping.
I'm curious if kinkeeping can be considered a kind of emotional labor, and if this is something that often falls more into the hands of the female members of the kinship unit than the male ones, or if it's become a kind of feminized labor.
I would agree that it can definitely fall more to women in a natural sort of conditioning way, but I think that the biology is the start, then what we do with it is the imaginative part, and that's open to anybody, and of course the rewards for it are open to anyone. So the pursuit of that, and then the discovery, just like ritual, as you do it, you discover the rewards of it are immeasurable, and you you know, begin to find the advantages come to yourself as well as to whoever you're extending yourself to in some way. And again, family is something we start with. The biology family is something we start with, but how we can add to that is up to us. That's the spiritual journey. And we don't have to stay only, there's also, we don't have to stay only with our biological family, but there's also the whole possibility of not only extending our families through, you know, seeking different roles with people in our life, even at different season and different times, but also the depth in each relationship is immeasurable, so that with one specific family member, say mother to daughter, father to son, or daughter to a father, these are the potential for depth there is amazing. And, you know, I think we often run into limited concepts of how powerful and exciting those places can be in our life. Even again, I mentioned before, thinking about this even past death, where you can activate relationships, for example, just through thought of contemplation about someone in your history, a parent you may have lost, or a grandparent you may have lost, or a sister, and memorializing. I'm using the word memorializing in a very big way, not just simply a rose at the grave sort of moment, but how we ritualize these micro rituals that we can pass through our days, where you have I have a pan with a lid on it that has arrows that my father instructed my mother, so this particular lid didn't fall in the pan, and they're precious. They're there. They inhabit my life, even while they don't in a physical way, but certainly in my spiritual, mental, and memorializing life. Yeah.
Now, I've heard it said that when one thinks of a dead relative, that's usually the result of that relative in the afterlife mentioning you in a conversation with another spirit. And that mentioning of your name in the conversation, like, oh my, you should see my great-great-great-great-grandson. He just finished medical school. I'm so proud of him. That makes you think of your great-great-great-great-grandmother.
Moving from the personal to the political and the social, I think that we can see that these kinds of rituals of historical memory occur also on a national scale, on a social, society-wide scale, that we have not only memorializations of putting up a monument, but these rituals of, say, a parade, or even perhaps more localized rituals of speaking a certain name and recalling a historical event that thus, by doing so, produces our understanding of the national.
Well, and I'll also add to that, that it happens at a radio show level, right? This is a big ritual where we all come together and join the circle at the same time for years now.
Well, let's perform another ritual that we like to do here, which is to expand the circle. So if you'd like to join the circle briefly, the number is 617-253-8810, and we have two lines available. Caller, marhaban.
Hey, is this Mike?
I'm sorry, you are. You must have the wrong number. You are on the air.
Is Mike there? What's your name?
This is Dr. Janice Sakran on Music for Healing.
Okay. I was given this number by Mike Tay. This is Kermit. We just pulled into Boston. I was told you knew where to score some blow.
So it's interesting. It's like we have yet another ritual, right?
Dr. Jalas, I think I'm not hearing the caller, unfortunately.
Oh, is that right? Well,
let's get those wires connected.
Yeah, we'll indicate that to our engineer. But
well, just
in
to
the
maybe
meantime,
recap what the caller said.
Yeah, please do.
He
so.
Seemed to perhaps have had the wrong number. I would hope so. He was asking for a certain mic. He mentioned that he had just arrived in Boston, and he thought Mike would be of some assistance in scoring some blow.
Yeah, these were the words that he used. But I think it would be...
That's not okay on the air.
No, it's not really what we want. And I'm sure that it was a joke of some kind. But in the meantime, back to this idea of the fictional political narrative, and I think that, or I'm sorry, Bria used the term fictive. which may or may not be something that is fictional. But I think it's very important to remember the fictional things as well, because it's popular to sensationalize our national figures in a way that is beyond obviously what they did or their truth. But I think that it gives us a connection with them, a personal connection with them, that, you know, we even have these... I've seen these slogans, which are things like "What would Jesus do?" or something, and based on I'm not sure what narratives. But the point there is that these people clearly feel a connection with someone that they have never met.
Yeah, and I think many people would have liked or would prefer that their actual father would be replaced by Barack Obama, for example.
Well, to a certain extent, these, for example, when people follow these celebrities of the day or other famous figures, they are appealing to their empty spirituality and their loneliness, that they are surrounding themselves with these false people that they've never met, and with the news and stories and gossip, to empty this hole that they feel within them that we can fill with prayer and meditation.
And I mean, so you mentioned prayer. I mean, how was this filled in the, you know, I mean, was there a time when our ancestors were not capable of prayer?
Well, I believe that these sorts of things have gone in and out of popularity. But people have always been spiritual. I'm sure that our guest can atone to that with the archaeology, but people have always been spiritual. People have always reached out to each other through spiritual planes and to gods and figures which they have.
Well, I mean, taking an evolutionary time view of man, I mean, at some point we were, you know, we had a common ancestor with an ape.
And the worm, right?
Perhaps later ancestor.
Fish.
But do we believe that the ape is a spiritual being as we are?
Well, it's. I think it's too much for us to assume that the ape or the cat or dog or other creature that we are surrounded by are incapable of prayer, are incapable of these spiritual notions, that since we don't know personally, it is somewhat arrogant to assume that we are the only ones. Perhaps dolphins are also... There are many rituals that animals go through that we don't understand.
Yes, I can think of I can think of the elephants and their memorializing habits as they move through different landscapes, where they stop and recall lost members of a particular group of elephants, or their burial rituals. There's clearly something going on there that's very, very interesting, and I would love to connect the idea of memorializing, ritualizing, and identity formation. And I think that identity formation, we use rituals and we use family members, and including new people we encounter in our life and include in our life. To me, they're all part of the need for identity shaping, forming, expanding that's possible to us. That's a very exciting thought, and I think prayer too is part of that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, when you mentioned the elephant, it makes me think very deeply about prayer. I realized at one point that very early on that there was a difference between bending one's knees and praying and just imagining the words. And so it may be difficult for anyone that has not explored their own ancestry or experimented with various rituals that have some historical grounding to imagine what the effect would be.
Yeah, and this bending of the knees is a very interesting phrase. I know it's used in the Hebrew Bible, and I've often wondered why bending of the knees is better than bending of the elbows. And they're both joints, they both can be bent, they're both fairly supple.
From a vocal standpoint, I can say that when one bends their knees, it affects their vocal posture, it affects their breathing. Mm-hmm. And that can affect how their blood flows and how their mind works, whereas bending the elbows is not such a large effect.
I also think it implies being really close to the ground and lowering oneself, and maybe in a biological way to make oneself somewhat vulnerable.
So and I guess to really lower oneself, one could dig a hole in the ground and go into the hole.
And I think that's also a very spiritual thing.
Is that a form of prayer in some religions, to enter a pit?
I'm not sure if a formal religion has that as part of the ritual, but I think it can be a deeply spiritual thing.
Well, it depends on what works for you. I've often had a friend bury me in the sand upon the beaches, and if any of you have had that experience, perhaps it's not a spiritual one for you, but it can be very soothing to lie there and feel the weight of the sand covering your body.
Yeah, some people like vacuum beds as well.
There are certainly many stories or accounts, historical accounts, of major spiritual leaders going into caves, which are a kind of natural form of pit, which are not opening up to the sky, but actually farther into the ground where the sun does not shine, and may be, you know, sort of a hole with no openings out to the sun.
Perhaps that brings us back to a sort of womb-like atmosphere that we feel closer to.
So in a sense, simply someone can feel spiritual simply by being enclosed. But
and the potato also. I mean, there's this dichotomy between root vegetables and grains. You know, the grain growing up out of the ground, up to the heavens, almost prostrating itself, and then this earthy, tuber growing underground, needing very little of that sunlight and just self-sufficient, just in the deep soil.
Yeah, to me, Arthur, I've always thought that this relationship was like the person who, as a Muslim, that there is a tradition that one would circumambulate, and either, when they go to when they go to Mecca, that they would like to touch the Kaaba, the black rock, and I always had in my mind the image of these two plants, but embodied in two elders, and the one elder, who, many people being there, interprets the order to touch the rock literally, and hence forces his way through the crowd to touch the rock, and this being the grain which must see the sun. And the other scholar, he sees the people and he interprets the order to touch the rock as to reach his hand, in the direction of the rock, and to imagine that he is touching it. And this is, of course, the tuber whose leaves would absorb the sun's energy and form it into food.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sort of speaking of forced analogies, I wanted to go back to this story that I remember about Aurora in her youth when she was estranged from her family. She mentioned this, going back, this idea of fictive kinship and fictional kinship. And I remember it was very amusing. When Aurora was in this phase that she was reading Lord of the Rings series over and over again, and I think for a time she actually believed that her family were hobbits.
Well, I mean, this goes back to my short posture and curly hair, but I felt very akin to the hobbits at that phase in my life. I was very down to earth. I was more obsessed with the physical pleasure, such as eating. And I did smoke pipe, and I just felt very, very connected to the sort of happy-go-lucky, no troubles can hurt me atmosphere that the hobbits of the Shire seem to enjoy. But again, that goes to show that, a fictive kinship, if you can relate very well, so strongly to a novel, that it can bring you to tears, like The Lord of the Rings did to me, right. That you can feel the emotions of the person within the book, then how are they not part of your family as well?
But I think you're in danger of slipping into ficto-delusional pathology. You didn't quite get there, but it's a real danger in some people who read too many books. And I know the president is trying to encourage reading, and Laura Bush did so previously, but too much reading can actually lead to a sort of delusional state.
And what would
I would disagree with you, Dr. Levine. I don't think we can assert any kind of correlation here between reading and this imaginative state, because in the case of Aurora, this was clearly occurring in a period of estrangement. And I think that these kinds of imaginative fallacies are a psychosomatic response to a bad ancestor. And this can happen on an individual level where there's a break with the family, with the parents, and so there's a search for some other kind of parental figure, or this can happen on even a national scale. For example, the question of what it means to be German is always now fashioned in the quest of what do we do about Hitler? How can we relate to this bad ancestor? Americans perhaps will have to do something similar with current history, I'm not sure.
I think in the end, many people believe that books come from a sort of, if you engross yourself in books, you will perceive the universe as something different than it is, but it is important to remember that these books come from the universe, they come from the minds and the spirit of the people who wrote them, and that to dive into the books and to take them wholly.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that the books also are, there's some
they're a bearing of the soul of the author.
Precisely. So again, you are in really connecting with the book world. You are still connecting with a spiritual being. That is the author who has a soul and,
exactly.
and is connected.
And that's the first idea that made sense to me as to the spirituality and the non-physicality of the mm-hmm. of the world as I see it today.
I mean, you know, Professor Levine, I think of reading of a group of people who behave in an honorable way or in a way that I would like to behave in, and I have this this idea in my mind that even if I'm not living among people like that, that there is still a benefit in feeling that connection and insisting on myself that I behave in a way that I also respect. It can inspire me.
Yeah, of course, then again, you have books like Mein Kampf. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But that was, of course, Hitler's book. So I think we have to be a little wary of the written word. It's pretty powerful and it can do a lot of damage. So I usually counsel my spiritual proteges to limit their reading to about 4, maybe 5 words a day.
Well, I believe
that the danger is not necessarily in the written word. It's in the interpretation and the actual application of violence.
And that's really where I would like to go. I mean, that I think that the words themselves can be harmful whether they are coming from a mouth or they are coming to you in a dream or in a book or if you read them on a wall or if they were spoken to you by your mother while you were in the womb, that these ideas on violence, that it's not the book itself that brings them to life.
It's more the way the book is read to you, the tone of voice that's used by your mother when you're a child, when she's reading bedtime stories to you. She might scare you and instill a dread of the world and a desire for revenge if she reads them in a certain way.
I think that that you witnessing your mother experiencing certain hardships would also would add to that and give the reading a flavor that it would not have had.
Kind of tearful reading, perhaps.
Well, but again, just bringing in childhood reading, I mean, that's again getting into a ritual. And when you go back to how ritualism just shared with humans, it gets me thinking again about what it is that separates us. And I think people get hung up on how different humans are. And I think one of the ways to put it is that everybody has consciousness and conscience, right? Consciousness is up here, conscience is in the heart. And maybe humans just get blinded by a little bit too much up there, you know, and it gets hard to just experience your surroundings. And actually, one of the ways that I met Bria was during a lunch talk when everybody engaged in painting the whole time. It was just kind of this nonlinear experience.
Wait, panting or painting?
Painting.
Panting.
No, painting.
Oh, painting.
You know, watercolors.
I see. Okay.
Graphic drawing.
And you know, this idea of ritual too is I remember discovering that many of the people around me had rituals when I was in university, because it was something obviously that we all have, and we all establish rituals, and I think that we could not live without them. And I began perhaps cruelly experimenting on the people around me in subtle ways, forcing them to break their rituals. I remember that I had a professor in particular who, he would walk into the classroom and there are hooks on the wall, and he would hang his coat on the same hook every day. So once when his back was turned, I would move his coat one hook over, you know, on either side. And it was alarming just how disturbed he was, because his pattern had been broken, you know. And
he must have known that somebody moved it then, right?
He struggled very, very hard to explain it, but the class was so amused that they all protested that it was where he put the hook.
If I'm not mistaken, this professor is Nasser, right? The great pan-Arab leader. And it was a result of this incident which led him to his militant pan-Arab views.
No. Nasser was far after I left university.
Well, it reminds me of a sort of mischievous incident when I was a student many decades ago. We had a professor who would drink coffee every day, and he would bring in a disposable coffee cup, and about 20 minutes into the lecture, he would finish his coffee cup and throw it into the trash can in the room. So one day I decided to conceal myself inside the trash can before anyone had entered. So I was hiding in this trash can. All the students were in the lecture room. The professor was giving his lecture. I, of course, being a studious but mischievous student, was still taking notes from within the trash can. And finally, when it came time for the professor to throw out his coffee cup, I quickly caught it in the trash can, and I jumped out, and I yelled, "Surprise!" And indeed, he was very, very surprised.
Did the coffee not get on your notes?
Oh, well, the coffee was empty at that point. I think my notes already had multiple coffee stains, since I'm a heavy caffeine addict.
Well, on a more spiritual level, many of our listeners may know that I frequently go on trips and just out in the wilderness and just myself and whatever animals are around and the trees and the grass, and break the ritual of this capitalistic society, break the ritual of my vocal therapy practice, just to sit there and be myself and to meditate and to understand the animals that are around me and the instincts that drive them.
But Aurora, is this not a new ritual that you are forming?
It is, and the thing that I'm trying to express, the thought, is that everything that we do repetitively can be assigned the name of ritual. But what makes it a true ritual is that depth of, and perhaps our guests can expand on this better than I can with my half-formed thoughts, but it's a sort of deeper spirituality for us. It's a deeper feeling that this is something that we ought to do and that we repeat, because it connects us with our ancestors and it connects us with our descendants.
Well, I'd also be curious, Bria, if it has been tried that a person would live anti-ritualistically, that they would explicitly break with ritual, you know, constantly, so live randomly.
I think that people can't really live without ritual, and I'll tell you why, because I love ritual. I love to think about ritual, because conceptually I think it connects the pathways between the body and emotion and identity, and I'm always trying to push open the idea of ritual and helping people think about it in a bigger way. So I don't think it's really possible to live without ritual. I think you can reject rituals that you are inducted into, as we all are, social beings. I think we can stumble across rituals we practice unaware. It's a sort of becoming aware of them and then perhaps amplifying them in our life, choosing, selecting, letting some go that we
care to make a statement about it, of course, then that's identity forming. Mm-hmm. So ritual, to me, is very much connected to the idea of rhythm. And therefore, it sort of naturally comes to the surface of our life thoughts, actions, and emotions. But I would say that it's possible to have a ritual that you do just one time, a very meaningful ritual, where you would just take a specific item. I like to think of ritual, the material world, as our pantry for ritual recipes, and with an intention, create a particular act. It may be memorializing someone, or in this case, maybe a pet. We talked about pet, or a particular thought you may be having. You might ritualize it by writing it on your mirror in some way. In other words, really thinking about ritual in a very expansive way and putting it really right next to the word play.
But now, I'm sorry, but Birya, like, what's the distinction there between... So this whole... period of time, I'm thinking of ritual as, and there may be a language issue, but as something that that the practitioner would repeat, and that may or may not have significance. But what you are saying is that it's possible to have a ritual, but without repeating. So I assume that it's based on some significance.
I would wonder, actually, what is not a ritual?
That's my question too. It's been my question for a long time. What is not ritual, and what then? I think what's come to the fore in my thinking about what is a ritual has to do with the awareness in which we assign a specific meaning to our act.
So
I think we can have rituals that we do unaware as well, but. Again, bringing them more to the fore.
So well, I think that this
I'm struggling.
A little too broad of an idea, perhaps. Like, for example, I'm thinking of something that I did this morning that I really don't like to do, and I don't do often. I had to mail a letter to the government, a stupid survey that they send out to sort of infiltrate into my daily life and my personality. And that is not, to me, a ritual. It's not something that makes me feel spiritually, excited, and
right.
It's not something that I repeat often. And so perhaps because of those stipulations, we can sort of define a ritual that it is something that connects you to either yourself or to others around you.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
As a vocal therapist, I always think in resonances that rituals to me are things that are either repeated and sort of have a temporal resonance, or something that builds up within you and it has sort of a physical, sort of spiritual resonance within you.
Another example I thought of, and I think it's sort of equally distressing, is if I, for example, eat a bologna sandwich because salami, which is my favorite processed meat, is not available, then that is clearly not a ritual. That is a sandwich of necessity.
Well, I think that what we've isolated here is that an act that has a significance beyond itself, beyond the own, the movements and the mechanics, that maybe we can call that a ritual. And one of the things that can give it significance, perhaps, is that it is repeated.
I would argue that the way that the term ritual gets deployed in by New Age folks in most contexts, at least in a positive sense, is that a ritual, whatever it may be, whether it's drawing on an old tradition, it's establishing a new tradition, or if it's just doing something as a singularity, that when someone says, this is a ritual, and it's intended and described as such by the practitioner, then this is actually an intervention against the mundane state of late capitalism. And of course, there are also rotes and rituals associated with living out a life in late capitalism, such as going to the job, getting the paycheck, getting those letters from the government and mailing them back. That is not considered ritual. And I think that that this is also a very political statement to say what is a ritual and what's not a ritual, but I feel like this term is losing its conceptual significance now.
Can a person be a ritual?
Well, I would like to sort of speak again to the idea of ritual. If we can think about ritual as the use of the body itself to create or to stabilize a new identity, or in addition to our identity, then I think then we have something to work with. It's not just like whatever action happens to be part of our day.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a connection between ritual and identity that's very powerful, and that's why I think emotion is one of those pathways in there.
So that once again, a ritual could not be imposed on you, that could a person come to you and to, you know, force a change in your identity? And
well, maybe something like circumcision. We could think about that. We could think about christenings. People maybe grow out of them or change, decide they don't want to pursue a particular traditional path or religious path that their family may have given them. And again, I think that we could think about someone using ritual in that case to enhance their new identity or to add to it. I think we are given ritual positions in societies. Things are done to us that we wouldn't acquiesce to at a later state in our identity. But there is something about identity formation going on in the use of ritual. And I'm just thinking how cool it would be for us to be aware of that and to be thinking how to create ritual in our life to enhance who we want to state ourselves to be, to ourselves, to others. And it's an interesting notion. And by the way, ritual isn't always positive. There's a lot of ritual. For example, this comes to mind, but people with compulsive disorders, that's a very classic case of ritualized behavior.
Where ritual becomes so important.
Well, right.
Bri, I'm so sorry to cut you off, but unfortunately we've reached the end of our time. It's been very nice having you with us.
I've enjoyed it too. I love listening to other people. What more graceful thing could we be doing?
Thank you so much. And also thanks to you, Arthur.
Lubanji, really great to be here.
As always, wonderful again to have my very gracious co-host, Dr. Zina van Kuchen.
Thank you, Solidarity.
And Aurora.
Namaste.
And the indubitable Professor Levine.
Inestimable is what I prefer, but thank you.
Cannot be estimated. I am Dr. Giles Sakran, the very estimatable here at Music for Humans on every Friday at 7 p.m. here on WMBR 88.1 FM in Cambridge. Stay tuned for Massachusetts Bay and Response. Ma'asalama.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first, before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians and unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
Hey everyone, this is Brad.
And this is Gina.
And this is Massachusetts Bay in Response. today we both have our own episodes, and next week I think is going to be our last week doing the normal programs that we've been doing. We're going to be switching over to some new projects that we'll introduce either next week or the week after, but I hope you guys enjoy the show this week.